This is episode 200 of this show. And to sort of get into things, this is being recorded sort of as a multi-part series. The second part has already been recorded with Rob Vojtovic, who some of you guys might know. He's a friend of the project and the show, and going in on sort of like the early origins of non-objective art in Russia, pre-Soviet, and also through the Soviet Union, and trying to figure out like what's really going on here. I sort of promised I would do this a while back after kind of spending a lot of time and sort of trying to figure out like what is an objective, non-objective art form? What's something that kind of engages with the world on its own realizing terms, instead of trying to whisper these things into becoming or being, and how to kind of engage with things environmentally? And, you know, there have been some artists on the show, you know, Final Hot Desert, Ben Tsang, and people who have been kind of like engaged with this practice for a while. And I think it's pretty timely, just considering how personas and personalities, and this has kind of been something that we've been harping on for a minute and trying, but it seems like people are kind of really, they're invested in this kind of desubjectified art. Like, what does art look like when it engages with the environment? What is the synthesis of the environment with man-made objects, whether it be something that doesn't have necessarily an art-specific bend, like the oil and gas industry, or something that does, like Nancy Holt's sun tunnels or Spiral Jetty or something like that. And so I think it's a good time to kind of revisit this subject and kind of trace like a basic history, not get too into specifics, because, you know, everyone can read, you know, and if anybody wants to read a book about it, they're definitely out there. But there are some things that I don't think have been like updated, and we're sort of asking these questions right now. You know, many things about, is a media project, when it's created by an artist or a musician, is it art? What is art? How do we rethink about these things and sort of calibrate our ability to understand, I don't know, things on a kind of like a spiritual, in a spiritual kind of way, you know, a human defining way, something that sort of like enriches us and reaffirms our humanity. And the human and the social, because of these, there are a lot of traps that are being set up that just have to do with representation and subjectivity, and kind of looking back into the kind of history of where all this stuff started, from the cave paintings to spiritualist art through suprematism, and kind of like the delinking of this kind of higher quality with contemporary art and music and media. And how all these things kind of like fit together in this weird historical puzzle that kind of, it's interesting because non-objective art in many ways was a way to sort of decouple time from space. Time is something that we realize historically. It's something that we, as human beings, we imprint on the cosmos, on space itself. And I think that's kind of where we're getting at right now, is that space, when we talk about cosmic time, we're sort of talking about space and spatiality and this kind of notion of like the infinite expanse and the determinism of, you know, the creation of the world and what things are predetermined, what things do we have control over, how do we aid this control, how do we elucidate the things that exist in the world without necessarily within a kind of order or moral will of the universe, if it has such a thing. I don't know, that's another question to ask. So to kind of get into this, I think we should sort of trace some of the early examples of non-objective art and where these things have kind of gone. The history of non-objective or abstract art kind of traces the evolution of artistic expression away from literal representation and towards forms that emphasize color, shapes, and emotions. And so the early foundations of this are pretty interesting, and they predate the 20th century. So even while abstract art became formally recognized in the 20th century, its roots lie in ancient history, with geometric patterns and stylized forms appearing in non-representational ways. One example would be early cave art, like the geometric patterns in Chauvet, the caves. And so these hinted at abstraction, even though they were kind of like primitive attempts to represent the world, because people didn't have the tools or the technical skill in order to represent the world as we see, you know, kind of more famously with like Rembrandt or some of the Dutch masters. But it still kind of looks that way, you know. And another one would be like Islamic art. And so because of the religious restrictions on figurative imagery, Islamic art emphasized these intricate geometric designs and calligraphy. So calligraphy would be a kind of way, like this notion of like ornamentalism that came from, in the Old Testament, the representation of higher spiritual figures had to be kind of abstracted in a way as well, because it was kind of an affront to the creations of God or the creations of a sort of like of a higher being. And in medieval and Byzantine art, they had a lot of decorative symbolic forms. And in the manuscripts and mosaics that sort of adorn the outset of the word, I think all of that is really sort of interesting, because what Kandinsky tried to do, and you could see this in his letters to Alexander Kojève, is he talked about ornamental art being sort of different than abstract or non-objective art. You know, Kandinsky wanted these things to sort of exist as objects for their own sake. They weren't ornamental. They were contained within a frame or within a piece of paper or on a lithograph or in a painting. These abstractions kind of existed as their own sake. They weren't ornamental for anything beyond, you know, like they weren't sort of, he tried to make a sort of hard distinction between that and the decorative arts. And so proto-abstraction in the 19th century, a lot of artists, they began experimenting with abstraction, especially in the late 1800s. So Romanticism and Symbolism, artists like William Blake and James Whistler, they explored spiritual and atmospheric qualities that prioritized mood over realism. So this was kind of like an early foundation of that. You see a lot of that in like JMW Turner's work too. Even though they're sort of landscapes, it's kind of a vibe, it's a mood, it's this, you know, really sort of hazy, up for interpretation. You know, it wasn't baked in literalism. And Impressionism and Post-Impressionism, so like Claude Monet, Vincent van Gogh, they sort of fragmented these natural forms, which paved the way for abstraction. And then there's Art Nouveau, so Gustav Klimt, and he used decorative patterns that flirted with these non-representational aesthetics. The birth of abstract art happened in the early 20th century. And abstract art, that's when it sort of emerged as a deliberate movement and challenged traditional representation based on a concept of that. And so the pioneers of this are Wassily Kandinsky. He's often credited as the first abstract artist. And Kandinsky's work kind of aimed to express spiritual truth through color and form in his many compositions, like Composition 7. Kazimir Malevich. So Malevich's Suprematism, which we sort of go into quite a bit later, exemplified by Black Square, it celebrated this pure geometric abstraction that neither looked towards the past in horror or the future towards the horror. And suprematism was kind of in line with the Russian cosmos in that it saw death and rebirth as this thing that goes beyond beyond the sort of the way society normally views these things. You know, it sees them on a kind of grander scale, a more cosmic timeline. Mondrian and his De Stael stuff, like the composition with red, blue, and yellow, and this is 1930, and it emphasizes balance through grids and primary colors. Then you had Cubism, George Brock, and he's deconstructed objects into geometric forms. You had Futurism and Constructivism, which focused on dynamic motion and industrial modernity, particularly in Russia and also in Italy with artists like Afro. And not just that, you also had Wyndham Lewis and the Vorticists as well. Then we get into abstract expressionism, and this is where things kind of got interesting with the general three-letter agency push, because this was kind of the first time that abstraction was used for overt ideological aims. You know, this is when it kind of got captured and co-opted like so many things do, because it de-emphasized the political dimension of the materiality and became about this kind of like decoupled form of self-expression that we sort of see with podcasting, or we sort of see with post-internet art, is that once we sort of stray away from the material ramifications, which are inherently political, you know, I think people view like, is there too much politics in art? I think what they're really sort of asking is, there's too much identity and subjectivity based in art, and does that obscure some of the political or productive tendencies that exist within creating anything? Because everything that you make is political, you know, because it's time stamped into a productive pattern that is at the sort of root or base of the superstructural culture that it comes out of. And so I think it's a little bit of a misnomer. And, you know, there was a Harper's essay that said, that sort of posed that question, is art too political? And I would say the kind of identity obsession and the obsession with the figure and the human experience and the human subject, I think it's all interesting to ask questions like, what does a more innocent world look like? Can we look at things that don't have to do with capitalism, but then it gets recaptured by it, you know? So people are looking towards, you know, primitivism and folk art and art from like different cultures and backgrounds and subjectivities. I think that's a positive thing, but I think it obscures something that's also deeply political, which form is inherently political. Because form, you know, it expresses a will. And that you could see this kind of with the artists of the early guilds, you know, like art is always political because it's a social expression that's expressed through an individual who has the tools and crafts to express it. So even if it's expressed from the perspective of an individual, it always emerges from a group, like no matter what. And that's just kind of the way it works. And so it is, you know, in a sense, it's a multi-dialectical process. It's not neither positive nor negative. It spans a lot of dialectical tendencies. Now we can sort of look at the totem pole. And I think the totem pole is a really good example of something that is political because it emerges from a group conscious. It's engages with this, you know, a deeper sort of cultural shared spirituality. And it's also decorative. You know, it sort of fits all of these parameters. Because what happened to Kandinsky is, it, you know, you can see Redbubble merchandise, you know, like you see it in museum shops. You see this, like, abstract expressionism became a form of, you know, it became a kind of a group consciousness of neoliberalism, or whatever you want to kind of call it. like almost everything does, like identity-based art. So what I'm trying to look into is what are some new ways we can reappropriate this? Like, how can we actually sort of create something? And so a lot of the totem poles, they were sort of emblematic of these histories and identities of clans that were told through totem figures. And so abalone shell inlays would be a particular feature of a certain clan. And I'm going to read a little bit of a book, an introduction book. And this was a book that was passed down through my family about the carved history, the totem poles, and house posts of Sitka National Historical Parks. And this is something that's been in the family for a while, you know, thinking about indigeneity, thinking about what it means to emerge from a group, what it means to engage with marginality in not a kind of post hoc or reductive way or a overtly politically correct or overly sensitive way, but in a way that sort of engages us with who we are through a place of memory, through a place of being lost, through a place of what did our ancestors do? How did they think? How did these patterns affect us, and how do we navigate them in the present day? And so instead of going to this, you know, place of, well, our subjectivities are these things that we can't joke about, we can't make off-color jokes anymore. Everything is baked in this incredibly self-serious, which I think self-seriousness is a form of depoliticization. And John Duns Scotus actually wrote a lot about this, who was, you know, kind of a proto figure, especially in the early, Bakhtinin wrote a little bit about this. It's sort of like a proto figure in some forms of early Soviet communist intellectual circle. And so the introduction is, in the old days is the way many of today's Tlingit elders, Tlingit is a tribe that is based currently today and in the past in the Pacific Northwest. In the old days is the way a lot of the elders begin their stories. In the old days, the way of life was based on the rich natural resources of Southeast Alaska, on respect for all living things, and on a unique and complex social structure. That's a big one. Basing the symbolic on the complexities of social structure. And Claude Lévi-Strauss had a good book on the totemic as well, which I could maybe get into a bit. And so the totem poles are a reflection of these ways. They are bold statements making public record of the lives and history of the people who had them carved, and represent pride in clans and ancestors. They mark the success and renown of families. In the old days, quote unquote, the poles were not found along a neat lane as they are now in Sitka. Step back in time and see them as they used to stand. Imagine yourself a trader on a European ship plying these waters during the early 19th century fur trade era. Ahead, close by the water, on the shore of a sheltered bay, is a row of single-story rectangular cedar houses. The green mantle of the rainforest is close behind them, and the misty mountains rise above. Canoes are pulled up along the beach, and people are busy preparing to come out to the ship to trade. Towering above them, at the corners and in front of the houses, are carved poles whose striking design and colors proclaim the identities and stories of the villagers. If only you could read them. If only is a problem for us today. In many instances, we do not know enough about the people or their poles to satisfy our interests. We do know that poles stood along the village fronts of the Haida and Tlingit Alaskans of northern British Columbia and extreme southeast Alaska. For example, I consider southeast Alaska to be the Pacific Northwest. I consider the North Arctic slope to be the Pacific Northwest. And I say this, you know, just anecdotally, like, for example, in Fairbanks, Alaska, where a good part of my family is from, they root for the Seattle Seahawks, the NFL football team. I don't know if that means anything, but they kind of see themselves as culturally even in, you know, in this weird post-historical cultural space, it does have this kind of Java chip, Pacific Northwest coffee house kind of vibe to it. I don't know how to explain it. Nobody here has probably been to Fairbanks, Alaska, but I think they kind of see themselves like when they go vacation, they go to Seattle or they go to Tacoma, you know, or they go to British Columbia in Vancouver, which are pretty close, you know, it's not that far away. Now, Fairbanks is way up north, so it is pretty far, but compared to other cities and municipalities, you know, Seattle is the closest one. Vancouver is the closest one in Canada. So that's just a little bit of background there. So the name totem is not a local word, but is an Algonquin Indian term describing crests showing natural objects or animals that represent a family group. Totem can refer to an individual crest as well as a whole pole. And this kind of goes similarly to, you know, artist guilds that reached their climax in the 1300s. And, you know, and seeing that, you know, the artist guild is a really kind of funny thing to me, because I was thinking, like, you know, the artist patronage networks that worked throughout the early thousandth century from the 1100s onward. You know, they had their own crests, they had their own guilds, they were sort of, because they had patronage networks that wanted to be recognized as being, you know, emerging from the kings and emerging from the sort of royalty that enabled them. Similarly to totem poles with chiefs, you know, it's actually a very kind of similar structure. So we can't really divide the two. We can't infantilize one group and see them as primitive and pure and innocent, because that goes along with the narrative of the noble savage, you know, which is a kind of patronizing term that was seen as a kind of liberal term to denote that, you know, that the Indian could be sort of saved if they had the soul of a white person, you know, that it, you know, there was a saying that kill the soul, save the Indian, or kill the Indian, save the soul. I actually don't know the exact one, but this was used up through the 20th century, which I think is really kind of fascinating to see, you know, how progressivism kind of took off really sort of fast during the civil rights movement and led us to this kind of area that I don't want to say it took it too far, because I don't believe it did take it too far, but it obscured parts of civility that exists in parts of difference. And I think difference is ultimately really interesting, you know, a world swarming with worlds, to quote Walt Whitman. So if only. So, and this was to talk about crests. And so to begin to understand totem poles, it's necessary to know that the Tlingit and Haida people are each divided into two major groups called moieties, represented by the raven and the eagle in totem art. Within these major divisions are numerous clans. So there are divisions within divisions. Each clan shares legends, crests or symbols, ancestors and artifacts, and clan membership is an important source of identification and pride. This system exists today, although many native traditions are less closely followed than in the past. Totem poles generally serve one of four purposes. Crest poles give an ancestry of a particular family. History poles record the history of a clan. Legend poles illustrate folklore or real life experiences. Interesting that they don't separate folklore from real life experiences. You know, it's kind of that brings up a really weird point, because Straub and Huillet, who were these, they were a French duo, kind of radical, mostly did their stuff in Germany, in Italy. They kind of left France. They were kind of committed communists or whatever, in a bit of a LARPy sense. You know, Peter Handke said that they were in the 90s was like they're sort of, you know, just going all on this like outmoded form of class political radicalism that doesn't really serve a purpose. And Peter Handke was kind of known as a West German radical author, you know, perhaps at the time one of the most transgressive. So he was even saying stuff like this kind of radicalism is outdated, but that's neither here nor there. But I thought it was kind of interesting that when it comes to sort of folklore and experiences, all of their movies were based on, you know, unfinished work by Franz Kafka, unfinished work by Holderlin, Death of Empedocles. But so they set these movies in a kind of Brechtian way as the characters representing the texts, you know, like they didn't create new texts. They just kind of used verbatim from the old literature, but they set the characters in multi-temporal ways. So you'll see like, you know, Greek figures and there'll be like cars going across. And historically, it's a way to sort of show that even though the world changes, it's only the environment that changes. The actual stories of the death of Empedocles, the actual stories of these kind of folkloric tales or, you know, epic tales, they reanimate themselves throughout history constantly. And there's no sort of getting away from that, from the real movement of those things. And so I'll get into that a little bit more later because I think they're kind of an interesting example as well. It's so cool that they had different poles to illustrate different portions of life. And one of them is also really cool is the memorial pole, which commemorates particular individuals. So there are sort of places of individuals within this pantheon of folklore, experience, shared cultural histories, particular family emergences, and so on. And the first recorded sightings of this were by the European explorers and the traders that engaged with them in the late 18th century. So a totem is traditionally carved by an artist of a clan opposite the clan of the person who commissions it. Special occasions among the Tlingit sometimes prompt large celebrations that have come to be called potlatches. We've talked about potlatches quite a bit. New poles were often erected as part of the festivities, or were sometimes themselves the cause for a potlatch. Although missionaries and civil governments had almost wiped out large potlatches before World War I, a contemporary version is evolving. Now, how do we interpret totems? And I think this is kind of interesting in this pamphlet, which kind of outlines all the different totems. And there's no other sort of publications or markings on this thing. It just gives you kind of like further reading of Tlingit stories and Northwest Coast Indian art. This is kind of rare stuff, actually. It's by Eagle Printing Company, 1980, published in Anchorage, Alaska, and it's got a beautiful sort of embossed cover of a totem pole. And so the way we interpret these totems, you can almost say that nothing really changes. You know, we can interpret many things this way. And so a stroll through the park with particular attention paid to aesthetics will provide a taste of the skills of these creative and talented artists, of their forest and ocean world, and of their respect for every living thing in it. You know, Kantian America maxing. The brief narratives in this booklet describe the individual poles as well as records allow. In some cases, the records are conflicting, in others, there is little or nothing available. That scant amount, however, has helped many visitors deepen their understanding of the Tlingit and Haida people of Southeast Alaska. Interpretation of totem poles must be approached with caution. All interpretations have to be approached with caution, which is one of the dangers of Discord and X and social media, is that we don't cautiously approach the information that is presented before us. This is why I think long form Substacks and podcasts, I think that they can be positive in this way. When they devolve to gossip and, you know, stuff about your personal life, then it's problematic. Then you're creating a kind of negative relationship with an audience who's invested in, you know, what they call an Alcoholics Anonymous, compare and despair. How can I compare my life with yours? And people become sort of tethered to these comparisons, and they check in on people to see, oh, what is this person doing who has this thing that I think I should have, but they have, you know, it's like, that's really sort of unhealthy. The cautious form of interpretation, you know, and it's through elements of styles, you know, styles of the raven, the eagle, and beaver, you know, they can sort of be recognized in a deeper, more thorough knowledge of the people and the history. It's kind of necessary to interpret the story of any poll. You know, we always have to dig deeper. You know, we always have to kind of go into places that can be seen as boring or uninteresting, but this is where the good stuff is. You know, this is where the stuff that doesn't make me feel like shit is. You know, I'm really sort of interested in that. Not things that avail me relevance as a cultural commentator or, you know, somebody of high cultural standing. The things that avail you nothing in the way of status. That's where I get some form of fulfillment. That's almost the only way I can sort of keep doing this with a clear conscience, you know, because I do have ethical qualms about, you know, the engagement that, you know, this takes, you know. And I'm very sort of grateful that the audience is patient as well, and they don't expect a bazillion podcasts talking about every media item that ever exists and sort of giving anecdotally my opinion on it. As we'll see in another episode, utopianism is the greatest form of criticism. And Baudrillard called the desert the same thing. You know, this vast swath of where there's a deficit of sociology or society or imprinting of, you know, contemporary culture. It's an ecstatic critique. You know, that's what he called it. And I think that's such an interesting way of putting it. So to sort of know the deeper history. So when an animal or a raven is referred by a proper noun, the animal plays a role of a legendary cultural hero with human characteristics in that particular context. Lowercase references usually refer to the animal in a generic sense. Many of the stories and events associated with totem poles have been lost over time. Others are interpreted differently by different clans and communities. And so interpretation and legibility are two major issues. And we're not in a deficit of legibility, we're in an overabundance of legibility that doesn't create, so it's like we don't have folklore to explicate because everything is didactically explained through the process of the creation itself. This is kind of what differentiates older cultures from newer cultures. We're sort of looking for ways to engage with mythical things, but when we understand who's sort of behind the curtain, we understand who, you know, what kind of person, or we don't always know because it's impossible to know the individual psychology of anybody. We can't intimate that. You know, John Coltrane said, one of the things that's interesting about jazz music is you never really know what the audience thinks. And I think that's kind of true in any art form. You know, we never really know. We can understand, we understand the sort of will of what's being represented through the cultures that represent them. But when it comes to like somebody's psychology, that's just schlocky bullshit, you know, this fake psychoanalysis nonsense. So we can kind of move past that. But certain things have aura, and not in the kind of, you know, self-mythologizing way, in an actual historical way. And something cool kind of came up recently that I wanted to talk about. I don't want to get too anecdotal here, but I think it's of relevance, so I'm going to share it. Things that have aura, natural aura. I think we have to sort of make a distinction here between aura of the self-branding sense, you know, kind of post-hype Williams, Dean Blunt, like, you know, let's hide ourselves, you know, let's make a purposeful attempt. I'm more interested in the aura of things that make themselves explicit, that don't hide themselves, but are underspoken or under-talked about or under-researched. Or, you know, to me, those are the things that are kind of, you know, it's got a natural aura to it. You know, these sort of lost parts of history that very explicitly make their intentions known, but...